Don't miss your chance at a bumper sticker. Don't miss your chance at a bumper sticker. Okay, so today we're going to talk about what I'm thinking about in part as narrowcast, as looking at the telegraph. Just before we get underway, just a couple of points about what's out and about in the news to think about. I don't know if anybody saw, let's go to that one, this chap's obituary. Did anybody notice it? And did anyone know why perhaps you as a generation should be particularly in awe of this man? A laugh of scorn there. Okay, no one heard of him. Okay, he was a chief engineer at Sony. But he did two particular, he was involved in projects in two particularly significant things. One was he saw the importance of the transistor, and he said, I can put these inside radios, which used to have great big valves in. When we come to the computer, we'll talk a lot about those valves, probably. And that suddenly made what we call the wireless actually particularly wireless, because it no longer needed to plug into the wall. It now could run on a battery. And so the transistor radio, music that you could carry around in the street, is really to be traced to this man. Not only that, but he also came up with the idea of the Sony Walkman. The idea that you could choose your own music, stick it on a tape, stick it in your pocket, and put headphones on your head and wander around the street. So when you wander out with your earbuds and boogie to a little bit, think of this guy, because he was really the person who set us on that path. For good or for evil, you can decide. But he was. I kind of had my doubts, because the Walkman came out when I lived in Manhattan. And if you went to Washington Square Park on a Saturday afternoon, people would bring along these huge boom boxes. To call them to call them portable radios was hard to believe. Put out a huge sound. Everybody, it was the time of inline skates, and everybody, not me, would boogie together to these huge, loud music. And it was extraordinary. It was this kind of automatically coordinated scene. Halfway through my residency in New York, everybody went to the Sony Walkman, which meant they all had their own private music, which meant, A, you couldn't hear what they were boogieing to, and B, they didn't boogie together. Instead, they just collided with each other one-off, because everybody was living in their own world. So it was the step towards radical individualism, perhaps we can think of it. Okay, that aside, another one that was in the news today, in recent weeks, this was Rupert Murdoch, who we should think of not as a piece of British news, really, or as Australian news, but as American news, because he, of course, is an American citizen. He became an American citizen. Does anyone know why? Well, it's a topic for the day. In fact, it was in part to be able to extend his monopoly over news sources in New York City. So what we're reading about in the 19th century, this was happening at the end of the 20th century and extends today. And it is indeed about the extent to which news sources, A, can be, because what he really wants to take over is all the satellite TV for the United Kingdom, which will give him a kind of monopoly control. He's involved in a way in two battles. One is particularly in the United Kingdom, though, he's involved with a battle against the BBC. And if you ever see stories that are beating up on Murdoch, there are two sources you're likely to trace them to. In America, they're likely to trace them to the New York Times, because they're entering into a battle with his Wall Street Journal. And in the UK, it's going to be the BBC, because they know they're in a battle with Murdoch, who is trying to use a lot of his son is trying to use his political influence to say that the BBC is an unfair monopoly over the distribution of news. So those are, as you know, topics for today, this question of to what extent the government should or should not be involved in the distribution of news and information. And we'll get to your homeworks and how it broke down a little. But one question, I'm known for asking silly questions. So let's ask a silly question. Well, no, let's turn it around. Anybody here not use Google? Anybody here not use Facebook? One, two, three, four. Okay. Okay. Stout man. I'll put my hand up with you too. Okay. Anybody here not use in some form Twitter. Okay, so Twitter doesn't get up there. But Google and Facebook, all those people who use Google and Facebook, does anybody here have a concept with the problem of monopoly? Yeah, with the concept of monopoly, yeah. Of business monopoly. But yet, you're not unhappy to use these large quasi-monopolistic corporations for your... And, yeah? Okay, all right. We'll actually get to that question when we talk about search. I mean, it's an important point. Lots of people say, for instance, perhaps they ought to have an alternative. You were going to say something? Yeah. You are? Olivia. Hi. And that's on principle? She refuses to? But you feel you don't have a choice, right? Olivia? Is that more of what's true? So, but if it gives good enough service, which of course was often said about AT&T, then we kind of don't mind if it's a monopoly? How many of you actually use AT&T? As a service. Hands going. Okay. So there's some issue. I mean, so we'll come back to this. We'll come back when I come to your question. So I'll take some of your questions then, if I may. But just to say, we're going to be talking about monopolies, and we'll talk about this again when we talk about search and search engines. You are very much dealing in the world of monopolies, I want to say. So it's not just the 19th century. I mean, I think that Google now has 80% of search in the United States. It's even higher in Europe. It's up in the 90s in Europe. So it's very high. And that's quasi-monopolistic. People are insisting on talking, even though I put it off. You wanted to say. You are, sorry?
Yeah, my name's Harrison.
Harrison, yeah.
But Google has so many competitors. I don't understand how it's not the best of its competitors, but I think it's different than being the only person doing it.
I'm going to hold off on addressing that, though I will try to address till we actually come to search engines. But again, there are issues of natural monopolies, or whether it's just justified in having 90%, and therefore, you know, it's a good competitor, and nobody can beat it, and therefore we should let it go. Okay, so let's get on. We've got a lot to get through today. We got the telegraph, and then the telephone. I may not get to the telephone, and if we do, we may not get very much about it. I actually think that the telegraph, in many ways, is the significant issue for sort of what the issues we want to talk about, but let's see. But one point is, to make clear once again, having gone through this long period of talking about things like the public sphere and science and cafe society, we're back. And really not since printing, although an awful lot has gone on in between, are we back as a class with a technology. Finally, here we have something that we can say, we have an inventor, we have a machine, talk about questions about determinism again, did things change because of this machine, do we have all the things in place to start talking once more, as we did to some degree about print. Another thing that we have, which in some ways is advantageous, partly because of, we've talked about the press, public opinion, people getting their ideas out, communication. We have a much better source to talk to the eyewitnesses of the day, as it were, or to listen to them talk. Remember, I put this slide up very early with Young saying that the real central theme of history is not what happened, but what people felt about it when it was happening. And here we have a chance, you had a chance to read Morse's own words. You had a chance to read Colt's words in a way you didn't really about Gutenberg. We did perhaps to some degree when we talked about science and the like, but we're now as we get to a technology again, we're going to be looking at some of the inventors. We're going to have significant eyewitnesses, and eyewitnesses who in many ways thought about things as we've been saying people think about them today, as a radical change, as the world in their lifetime changing beyond any prior example. So, for instance, Henry Adams. Anyone can tell us who Henry Adams is? Anyone identify Henry Adams? He came from a chain of Adamses. His father was Charles Francis Adams, who was a politician. He ran, I think, for president and for vice president. His father was John Quincy Adams, who indeed was president, and his father was Samuel Adams, who, of course, we all know. So, here he is, out of a great line of American politicians, not only out of a line of American politicians, but a line that were absolutely instrumental in the American Revolution. So here's a guy who really knows what revolution is about. But he writes towards the end of his life, towards the end of the century, it was published, I think, after his death, he says, only on looking back 50 years later at his own figure in 1854, so at the end of the century, he's looking back to the middle of the century, and pondering on the needs of the 20th century. This is him writing his own autobiography, but it's slightly quirky, and particularly he refers to himself in the third person. He never says, I thought this or I thought that. He says, he thought this. So he says, he wondered whether, on the whole, the boy of 1854 stood nearer to the thought of 1904 or to that of the year one. In the calendar, we know when the year one is. Okay. So is he really closer to the Roman Empire than he is in some sense? So in essentials, the American boy of 1854 stood nearer to the year one. So he's absolutely clear about the transformation in his lifetime, that between 1854 and 1900, things changed so much that when he was a child, he had much more in common than with a figure in Rome in the year 5 AD. Than he did with somebody in the year 1900. So he saw change as absolutely dramatic and radical in his lifetime. So, as we've said before, this is not a new thought. People have thought this a long time. Before the boy was 6 years old, he had seen four impossibilities made actual: the ocean steamer, the railway, the electric telegraph, and the daguerreotype. So those are all in his lifetime. The last of those, anyone know what the daguerreotype is? Colin? They were the first photographs. In fact, they came from France, although the English like to put in a claim, with a man called Talbot in the late 1830s, developing almost exactly at the same time that the telegraph developed. And he saw these as so radical, something we've heard about, that really they changed the connection of life. Life was no longer like the past. There was continuity for 1800 and 50 years, and then there's this major break. And again, the eyewitnesses are giving us terms that we've heard again in this course and again recently about the society we're living through, talking about the telegraph, a revolution unsurpassed in moral grandeur by any discovery until the present day. Anybody recognize that line? Good to know. It was actually in the congressional testimony of 1838 that you all read. But still, I wouldn't expect you to remember just an individual line from it. This is the opening given by the congressman, Frederick O.J. Smith, known as Fogg Smith. Keep an eye on him, because we'll return to him in a little while. An interesting character. But he gives the introduction to that piece you read from 1838, which is followed by Morse's letter. He's the person who kind of introduces Morse to Congress and says, this is the man that we should fund. Also, it is evident that the system of telegraphing news is destined to supersede, and we talked about supersession, the idea that one technology will replace another. The telegraphing news is destined to supersede, in a great degree, the publication of commercial newspapers. Anyone recognize that? Good. Cult. Well done. Thank you, Paulie. So, good guess. Okay, so that was from the other reading. So here's language we've been talking about in general terms. Well, here now are the people of the day saying, look, this technology changes everything. Now, we want to take that into account. Clearly, the telegraph was enormously influential. We want to bear in mind that a lot of other things had gone on, many of which we talked about. One is the development of what we call scientific society, going back to the Royal Society. Because these guys now, particularly when we get to the telephone, we'll see if we get there, were no longer just tinkerers, were no longer really just people playing around in their barn and who came up with an idea. Morse attached himself to New York University, to a guy called Vail, who we'll talk about. He was kind of at the beginning of a notion of university-based research. When we get to the phone, we'll see much more of that. So there's a change there. The change in the notion of the public sphere, again, which we talked about, this idea that the public needs to have, is entitled to have news and information, and maybe it should be spread by government control. And that was part of what Henry George was talking about. Well, that idea we've seen develop from Café de Société 100 years ago, so that now it's a reasonable claim for people to say people have a right to news. It wasn't the case before the period we're talking about. Jeff talked about the organization of knowledge. Knowledge is now something which is far more organized in many different ways. That's bearing on these discoveries. And then something again we talked about very early on, not only technological revolution, but political revolution. And major political revolutions, both in the United States, clearly. And you see in the descriptions of the Telegraph, accounts that bear on the United States, both as a great locus of future business and innovation. We're a country that is going forward with new ideas. We can do new things as the old world couldn't. But also ideas about democracy, about the right of the people to be informed, about what is wrong about keeping ideas and information from the people. These are also shaping that debate and shaped some of the things that you read. Equally, there was a revolution in France. And in terms of the Telegraph, as we'll see in a moment, that was also very significant. Also, when Daguerre comes along with the photograph, that is seen in many ways as a sign of the vigor and the vibrancy of French society after the revolution. So technologies get tied into politics in many ways. Changing too, not to be overdone, but changing in the period coming up to the Telegraph, are changes in the way society is now shaped. One is long-distance trade. Now, there's barely a period in economic history when someone doesn't say, oh, trade has changed from local to long distance. Now goods are traded. It's always happening. And people say, well, this technology did it or that technology. Wine was traded around the Atlantic probably 2,000 or 3,000 years before this. Long distance trade has been around for a long time. So be cautious about those explanations. But something was changing somewhat in the nature of that. In particular, I think new markets were developing. Let me see if I can just turn off and get a little more light on that picture. Maybe not. Okay, throw you all in the dark. That's okay. And you still can't see it very well. This, the John Garth's American Progress I showed you before. This is a great sense. Look, America is moving westward. And with it is opening up new needs and new markets of one sort or another. It's slightly hard to see. What you can see is a view of the Native Americans as a kind of bison hunting savage. They're being pushed out by civilization, which is moving in behind them. First come the miners with their shovels and the settlers. But before too long, they're followed by stagecoaches. Now with regular movement of both people and news. But most important of all, in Garth's view, is this figure moving westward is clutching in her hand the cable of the telegraph. It's the telegraph that is taking us west and civilizing society. And we want to reach out with them with new ways of getting them information, of finding out what their needs are. And so the shifting population. So that, too, is significant, again, in shaping and framing the question of the telegraph. Again, not that it is entirely new. Through the modern period, the nature of intercommunication, going back in some ways to the Roman Empire, but certainly after the fall of the Roman Empire, as the European empires and states develop, notions of long-distance travel carrying first the military and then goods and money from town to town and place to place and location to location. And in fact, those Roman roads, many of the crossroads are still viable market towns today, shaped by the development of these towns. We didn't this year have a class on the post office, so and I'm not going to try and fill all that in now, but the development of the post office, going back to Herodotus, but right up to now, was enormously significant. And you can see the debate about the post office again in what you read. The development of regular, stable, carrying traffic, particularly of news and messages across Europe, in some ways can be traced to this man, Franz von Tassis, who in 1489, from what we now think of Hungary, set out a set of routes along which he would carry messages for a fee. Tassis, whose name is spelt in a number of ways, gave us one of the most common words, not in the English language, but in all language, that is in almost any country, that particularly those that use the Roman alphabet, you will find his name pretty soon after you arrive. What, anyone know what word he gave rise to? Taxi. It's also spelled with an X. That's why we call taxis, because in the 15th century, this man developed a route of networks across Europe, and we still, in some sense, are in his debt, or perhaps in his wealth, in fact, as the family still exists today, enormously wealthy in high society Europe. That is, I think, the current Franz von Tassis, an elegant young man in a jacket. Also then changing was not simply the fact that these routes were now open, that roads were better, you could travel them in all weather, that horses now moved along them. Two things, I think, that come back to what we talked about a little about the telegraph. It's not simply having the route open, but and it's not, in fact, as Morse talks about a great deal, about the speed of connectivity that is the most essential thing at first. It's probably the regularity, the frequency and the regularity, knowing that the mail will go out at absolutely stable intervals, knowing how long it will take, changed a great deal about how people could communicate with one another. One of the key, a lot of this, of course, was done by land, but a lot was also by sea. Originally, when you wanted to send messages from Spain to England or from Amsterdam to Africa, you would wait until someone had a cargo of goods to take in that direction, and you would then ask the captain to take your letter with you. So it was a matter of waiting and just hoping something would. So you knew there was, or you didn't know, really, when it would go or when it would arrive. And if someone had a cargo and suddenly discovered that the market for pigskins was actually better in South America than it was in South Africa, he might simply just redirect his ship, taking your letter destined for the Cape off in another direction entirely. So when these things called packet boats, which were really designed primarily to carry the mail and increasingly left on regular schedules so you knew when they would go, you knew where they would go, you knew how often they would go, and you knew, unless there was a war, how long they would take, and they were armed to fend off pirates, they changed things a great deal too, in that now communication was much more regular. So just as Tassis gave us a name that we still use in some tribute today, so these boats did. What is the heritage of these boats? What acknowledged, in some ways, the importance of these boats to a communications revolution? How do our messages travel across the internet? In packets. And why are they called packets? Thank you, because of the packet boat. Good, all right. So this, again, is something that had an enormous effect, so much so that when Norman Davis, the little Welshman who thought up the notion of packet switching, thought about it, he said, let's call them packets. Developing along, too, at the same time, then, was more and more of what we conventionally think of as infrastructure. So we start to get canals developing in Europe, for the most part, in the 18th century, coming to North America with huge ventures like the Erie Canal at the beginning of the 19th century. What, and again with Morse in mind, do you think is the challenge of a concept like saying, I want to put in a canal to connect Lake Erie with the Hudson River? Raising money is one, but what's the other? Sorry? Do people want it? Okay, well, presumably raising money in some sense would answer some of those questions. People have an idea, well, I'll invest because I think people want it. But it's an important point. Demand becomes very important in this. So Alison's answer is a good one. Yes? People living on the land. And this, again, right of way, the right to say, I'm going to put a canal right across the middle of your land, or a railway right across the, or indeed the right to refuse. The right to sit there and wait till everybody else has sold their land and say, I'm not going to sell until you give me entire ownership of the company, because your bargaining rights are extraordinary where you're the last person. So how both the individual, the private company, and the state negotiates those rights becomes enormously tricky issues. Once you want to say, I'm going to build this not just across my land or across my neighbor's land, but from here to there and everybody in between has to fall in. Now, in the States, in some ways, it was moderately easy for large sections because they were owned by the government and unpopulated. And the government gave away huge chunks of land to the railway company that it owned. But when you come to Europe, where the land has been owned by small families and holders for years and years and years, it's a very difficult proposition. And the question of government intervention becomes immense. We also see, therefore, we see the development of roads, we see the development of canals and railways, and as we get to the next stages of the telegraph and the telephone, we're going to see extraordinary things like this, where the streets were more or less covered in wires from competing companies, from one company selling both, having different services, and you start to see, and you'll, I'm sure, have seen these photographs of New York in particular, just draped in wires. And again, the question comes, well, should, if what we think is good for business is competition, we don't want government intervention, we want competition, do we just then say, well, it's open season, anybody can come along and build a large pole and carry wires along this street, anybody can dig up my street and put another gas main down and offer a rival gas main service? Just until, in fact, rather than having snow on the ground, you get no snow on the ground because you have this kind of perfect umbrella made up of telegraph wires across the street. These become really challenging questions because if we believe in competition, in theory, anybody should be able to come along and set up a rival business. There are no problems to that. Coming along too then, though, although I said speed is probably less important in early days than regularity, speed is changing a lot. We saw how, in that earlier slide, I didn't comment on it, but how the speed of getting a letter across Europe goes from being something like 38 days, you know, down to a matter of days. So from the mail coach, which itself was a revolution, it could go there at about 8 miles an hour, we get to the railway, which is now going 20 to 30 miles an hour. And that's a dramatic difference. Dramatic difference for moving people around, but also for moving communications around. So this is going on all around these developments, and when the telegraph comes along, it's inserted into this world rather than just put onto a blank slate. Now, in fact, when we talked about early printing, we also remembered in some way, pointed out, and Eisenstein talks a bit about this, how it was inserted in an existing communications network. But it certainly wasn't one that put as many demands on public space, on the government, on ideas of what the public was entitled to and not entitled to until we really get to the 19th century. You could set up a print shop in a small town, and the one person who might get worried is the governor of the town because he worried about seditious attacks on his government or whatever. But it wasn't the kind of infrastructural demand that these new technologies of the 19th century were placing. So that brings in all sorts of political questions that we have to think about. And then that raises the question, well, different countries have different political assumptions. We go from more centralized states to more distributed ideas of the state. France was, always has been, still is in many ways, a particularly centralized state and believes that centralization is the right way that a state should be formed. Britain comes a little more loosey-goosey than that, but is still, compared to here, fairly centralized. So, for instance, the BBC, like France Radio, is in fact, you know, controlled or paid for, not controlled, but paid for by the government, and people think that's right, that the government should have. Whereas here, NPR is, as you know probably at the moment, under deep attack that the government shouldn't have such a thing as a national public radio. Now, those are deeply, deeply instilled in the notion of how the state is formed and built, and therefore how these technologies are going to be used. And in fact, even within this country, those who were really fairly strongly in favor of a federally strong government looked a little more like Europeans, while those who believe more and more in states' rights tended more and more to say there shouldn't be any kind of central control. And that plays out in how these things are distributed. And then that bears down on our notions of the public and the private. That is, who has the greater rights? Are public rights to information, for instance, stronger than private rights to property, to control of an individual company without interference from the government? These are all sorts of things that, in looking at earlier technologies, we haven't really had to think about so much, but now are going to become very strong. Then the question of, well, if we don't have state monopoly because we think the state shouldn't have control, do we allow private monopoly? And if we don't allow private monopoly, to what extent does that bring in the demands of public monopoly? So huge, huge questions. And one reason that those become very significant questions is because now we think in many ways of these new technologies as Alison said, in some ways designed for or in response to the consumer, and saying what I have to do is attract enough customers to keep my business going. But in fact, there were other interests at stake. Babbage, Charles Babbage. Anyone quickly tell us who Charles Babbage is? We'll meet him again this semester. Babbage? Kevin. He invented a calculating machine, which some see really as the first prototype computer. Some were built. He designed also a programmable one that basically could run programs. And so some see him as the father of the computer in many ways. He, in an early mention of the telegraph, says, but reminds us in many ways why telegraphs developed. Telegraphs are machines for conveying information over extensive lines with great rapidity. They have generally been established for the purpose of transmitting information during war, but the increasing wants of man will probably soon render them subservient to more peaceful objects. So, national interest, and particularly national military interest, is driving a lot of these things. Just bear that quotation in mind. We'll come back to it again. But what we start to see, particularly with certain nations in mind, are not simply connections within the state, but rather, as we saw looking back to those Roman roads, connections between states. So here, for instance, is a map, if you can see it, of the telegraph connections by the end of the 19th century. And although, of course, they run within connections, here you can see what's enormously significant about them is the way in which they run between states. And that's going to give rise to all sorts of questions. But before we get to those questions, we might just compare this map with this map. Anyone know what the top map is? Yeah. It's the internet connections. Those are the cables which carry the internet. Not very different, I would say, one from the other. While we think of this as a radically new technology, note how quickly and easily it follows the roots of the old communication system. That raises all sorts of questions. One is simply the challenge of laying cables and getting connections. But it ain't just cables now. It's obviously got to be treaties for agree to people to have their company put down a line across your land or lead information into your land. It also says, well, look, we could have every country just distribute its information as if it could afford it, as it chooses to, around the world, you know, from it treating itself as the center of a network. But in fact, what tends to happen is certain dominant forces end up saying, no, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll lay the line down for you. Trust me. And so, though you can barely see it, that little island off the north of Europe plays a good role in this in saying, look, send all your cables through us, which gives them two great opportunities. What are those opportunities? Andrew, yes. So they can, well, so three opportunities there. One, they can make money out of everybody's communication. Right, absolutely right, true. That's one. Others? Yes. They can decide who to give the information to and who to cut off. And cutting cables became quite a pastime in the 19th century. At the same time, also, northern European countries, particularly Denmark, began to offer priority cable routing through Denmark to get away from those British because you couldn't trust them. So you get a series of treaties, you get these links, you get the ability to control other people's communications, and you also get the ability to make sure that information that you don't like doesn't come along those lines into your country if you're not very keen on it. Something that we have seen more recently in the map of internet traffic to Libya. So, again, what we start to see are, on the one hand, these vast distributed systems, but that have choke points, which if you can control those choke points, you have enormous amounts of power, either financial or political and military. So into this story of the developing world, not quite yet of the cables, I can say, comes our hero, Morse. Samuel Morse comes along, and here he is. Now we're back in the world where we have the inventor of a telegraph. And so, as the New York Times said, you know, just after he died, the great inventor to convince the world of a new, and what he did was to convince the world of a new method of imparting information on a higher plane than that accorded to mere inventors. And in fact, in 1871, so great was his contribution seen by the American public that they had a day of celebration, and his statue, which I'm pretty sure still stands, was erected in Central Park in New York. Here he is. We see him as the great inventor of our time. And as you saw in the beginning of that writing, Congressman Smith, Fogg Smith, begins by talking about this man. It's a great and incalculable practical importance, his telegraph, and usefulness to the country and ultimately to the whole world. It would be presumptuous to attempt to calculate its usefulness, political, commercial, or social. It is obvious, however, a revolution unsurpassed in moral grandeur by any discovery to the present day. So nothing that has been invented before compares with what Morse did. And when he gets his patent, and that's it up the top, or one of them, he got several, he begins in 1837 by applying, but when one is granted in 1844, Henry Ellsworth, who's head of the patent office and in charge of overseeing all invention that's registered in America, he says it's a matter of proud congratulation that we witness the rapid advancement of the arts and sciences on this side of the Atlantic. This is American invention. And to hear how frequently the skill and experience of our citizens are purchased by the wisest monarchs of Europe. Blah, blah, blah. Among the most brilliant discoveries of the age, the electromagnetic telegraph deserves a conspicuous place, destined as it is to change as well as hasten transmission of intelligence, and so essentially to affect the welfare of society and all that concerns its further developments to be hailed as a joy. Then he goes on, to a native citizen belongs this merit. So here is Morse, the great inventor, and we see whether it's the statue in New York, whether we see it's a congressman from Maine, Smith, or whether we see it's Ellsworth in the patent office, he's our man. No question about it. Or is there no question about it? The statue in New York, and in fact the entire day, was arranged by Western Union. Western Union was at the time in an immense battle not to be privatized, not to be taken over, rather, by the state, not even to be regulated, but to remain a free and unregulated firm, despite its many monopolies. So, is one of its great obstacles was the fact that Morse had a long history of saying the government, in fact, should control the telegraph. So, Western Union went to enormous ends in the middle of this battle to flatter and to cajole and to praise Morse and to raise in the park his statue and to say, what a great man this is, he invented it, and Morse just kept very quiet and didn't remind people of his earlier writings. So we might hesitate to take the statue as evidence of his greatness. Smith, the congressman, who writes this great report, who introduces Morse to Congress, who says he must have his funding, and what a tremendous advance this telegraph is, didn't disclose when he wrote that report, and it wasn't disclosed until the 1860s, that 4 weeks before this went out, he had entered a private financial partnership with Morse, that any profits from the telegraph, 1/4 would be shared with Smith. Ellsworth, who makes the great claim that this is the greatest patent ever registered and the greatest design ever registered, would be a fine independent testimony, except that on the one hand, he wanted to defend the patent office from attacks by showing exactly how good and important it was to the American system, to the extent that he actually ignored earlier foreign patents for the telegraph. Not only that, but he was hoping that his daughter would marry Morse. So our great independent testimony of the time starts to look a little fragile when we see it. And in fact, one of the nicest pieces, if you're an unkind soul like myself, of testimony of the time, is put out by one of the assistants who worked on the project, mostly with Vail, a chap called William Baxter, who, when he wrote about it later, talking about Morse, said, it's singular that a series of mechanical and scientific failures, because Morse was a klutz, has given a man such a name and so proud a place in history. So we have to look at Morse with a certain caution as we tell this tale. As Morse up there, he was an odd bloke. He ran for mayor of New York on an anti-Irish ticket, didn't get in. He was also deeply segregationist even after the Civil War. He was an artist, he began. This is one of his paintings. He went to Europe, and on his way back began to think, as he describes it, about the nature of communication and the idea that if the presence of electricity could be made visible in any desired part of the circuit, I see no reason why intelligence, information as we might say now, can instantly be transmitted by electricity to any distance. And this is his great insight. Because the thing is, it wasn't only his insight. And what's interesting, if you read that article in 1838, is he's quite clear that a lot of other people are doing this too. In fact, many other people had been there first. So he talks about Gauss in Göttingen, Germany. He talks about the Manchester to Birmingham Railway, while he's still petitioning Congress for some money, is actually up and running with the telegraph beside it. Or the telegraph in Scotland. And when he writes again in 1839, he talks about the developments in England, Germany, and France. And when he writes to Congress again in 1842, he talks about other systems of the telegraph. So he himself, actually, until he gets deified at the end of his life, was quite clear that he was one among many, and that this was going on all over the place. And in fact, that was perhaps the thing to notice about Charles Babbage's claim about how the telegraph has been used for war. Anyone notice anything, having read the Morse passage, about that slide? '33, he's saying the telegraph's been around for a long time. You were reading in 1838 about the proposition for setting up a telegraph. And in fact, the prior art, which goes back a long way, and I'm going to say what Morse did, but we just want to be clear what he didn't do, goes back a long way. In fact, some of it traces it to a familiar figure for us. Old Robert Hooke, back in the Royal Society, actually said, you know, we can devise a system for transmitting messages by long distance. What we'll do is we'll have these big signs, and we'll have telescopes, and people will be able to change the signs, and from far away you can receive the message. And that, in fact, was how the first telegraph developed, not in England, but in fact in France, by this chap, Claude Chappe. He developed a line-of-sight telegraph, developed in France after the Revolution. The first one was parallel line, I think is, I didn't put the date up, 1794, I think. And this is, it goes from Paris, north of France in Lille. It has a series of stations along the way. At each station, there is one of these weird signs up on the top, and that is a sort of rotating arm which can be moved into different positions to represent different words or letters. And there's also a lookout with someone with a telegraph. So you send the telegraph from the top, the person in the next station takes it down by hand, then he transmits it to the next station, and through 16 stations, you can get around the country. So here is, in fact, the first working. So if the first was 16 stations, this, in fact, is the first message that's transmitted. It translates up there as, this is during the revolution, well, after the revolution, when there's sort of civil war within France. And here's the reporters arrive by telegraph, again, to the center of the Republic. And the city of Conde has been restored to the Republic. And you can just see it here. Conde or Condé être réduisé à République. Okay, so here's the message coming down. So those were the signals that you would actually see on the top of the house. So he gets the system up and running. It is seen, as I said, as a great French triumph. So the establishment of the telegraph is the best response to the publicists who think that France is too large to form a republic. The telegraph shortens the distance and in a way brings an immense population together at a single point. It's a republican aspiration, and this will be behind ideas of the American telegraph as well. Now, it wasn't just that single system. By the end of the century, or in fact into the next century, it was an entire network all the way around France. And you could send messages across, through, or around France with great speed, relatively. France not long ago, was driving along. Well, you can't see it very well in this light, but in fact, some of these buildings still exist. It used to have a Chape semaphore on top of it. Most of the building is gone, and they've put a statue of the Madonna in its place, but that was where the signal was. And so you get these great claims that we talked about at the beginning of the semester once again about the bottom of this invention might suffice to make possible the establishment of democracy among a large population. No reason why it would not be possible for all the citizens of France to communicate their will. So it's a republican idea that all citizens are now interconnected with one another. It's a great, noble, social adventure. Of course, it ain't entirely social, again. What starts to happen is the military start to develop them. The British military get a much clunkier system, but it works for the moment to get messages from London to the coast and to the Navy. It has a very large effect in many ways in the Navy itself for signaling between ships. And this rather splendid chap, Home Popham, develops the system of flags, which is to be run by all navies for a very long time. And as many people said, you know, the British like to talk about the great victory at Trafalgar. It wasn't a victory due to the splendid strength of their sailors or the wonder of their ships. It was probably really due to the fact that they, unlike the French, could coordinate their ships by a system of telegraph among the ships. So that's the line of sight system. Now, clearly, we know, well, that really isn't what we think of as the telegraph. Along that time, many experiments with electricity, those we think of most famously by Franklin, and Franklin was involved in this, but elsewhere. How do you generate electricity? How far can it, in fact, circulate? there's the Leyden jar, which is used for creating a spark. There's Abbé Nollet, who is this strange abbot in France, who, in fact, communicated with Franklin quite a bit. And he does a great deal of research in the middle of the century into electricity. And he has the great advantage that as an abbot, you're in charge of a huge body of men, and they really have to obey your orders. Poor souls. So he wanted to work out how far you could get a line of electricity to transmit. So he made all his monks stand in a long line holding hands. Into one end, he put this huge electrical spark, and he waited to see if the guy at the other end jumped in the air in shock when the spark came out the other end. And gradually, he discovered that you could get 1 kilometer's length of monks, and the electricity would run through them all, and the guy at the end would jump. And of course, you know, you jump in obedience in a monastery, so you had to do it. So this was beginning to experiment with how far it would go. And people therefore clearly saw, well, if you can get it to go through a bundle of monks, you can probably do it in other ways where you don't have to tie people together. Maybe we can communicate along this. So, Gauss. Anybody here heard of Gauss before? Paulie, yeah, the scientists in the room are coming out. Yeah, Paulie, tell us. About electricity in particular, and Gauss is still a unit of measurement. He in Göttingen was able to set up a telegraph that was working in the observatory to communicate internally in 1833 along electric wires, and in fact Morse credits him with doing that. Schilling, this rather splendid chap here, he was able to develop a telegraph. He was German, in fact, but he was working in Russia, and he got a telegraph working in the Russian Admiralty to be able to communicate around the Admiralty. Most of these were internal to one building. In England, Cook, and perhaps more importantly, Wheatstone, who is an interesting guy, but I won't go into him, they together developed a telegraph, at first within King's College in London University, connecting rooms and sending messages from one room to another. But then he got a patent in 1837 for his telegraph and began to run it along railway lines. And the first major public one was along the Great Western Railway line from Paddington Station to communicate to trains or information about trains along the route. So all these were happily in place by 1838. Not only there, but here too, there were some very interesting experiments. One chap, Dyer, on Long Island, had a working electronic telegraph in the 1820s, but he was sued. He was sued for competing with the post office. He was sued because, in many ways, a Republican gesture, here we had a post office which is providing equally to everybody information. It's a great Republican notion. And someone is going to come along and privatize communication, and our Republican ideals will collapse. And he, in face of the suit, gave up. He decided, this is not for me. Joseph Henry, also in 1830, had an electric telegraph. He, I think if I remember right, is the chap who designs the stripes in the American flag. He did a design for the stars, but that was rejected. But the 13 stripes, I think, are due to him. So, if we cast our mind back to Carter's unkind account of what Gutenberg, in fact, did not invent, which is usually attributed to him. We talked about this with the printing press, that Gutenberg didn't invent most of the things attributed to him. We similarly have to say something the same about Morse. And in fact, Richard John, in his new book, does. He says, look, Morse didn't invent electromagnetism, as he's often attributed to have done. That was discovered by a Danish scientist. He didn't get steady current. That was by a British chemist. Wheatstone and Cook had installed an electric-powered signaling system several years before Morse, and Harrison Dyer had a workable telegraph on Long Island. So Morse is not the man in many ways. But in fairness, what did he do? Well, several things, I think, deserve some credit. The first is actually, oddly, that he reintroduced the idea of the electric telegraph after Dyer and Harrison's experiments were abandoned. The message you read to Congress in 1838 was in fact a Treasury message sent out to say, shall we, so let's have a government appeal for people to design a telegraph for the government. So it wasn't begun in the private sector, it was begun by government. Of the 18 replies, 17 were for line of sight telegraphs. Somehow people had forgotten or didn't want to compete with the post office for the electric telegraph. Morse was the only one who offered an electric telegraph, drawing on the earlier systems. He introduced the binary code, known as Morse code. In fact, in some ways, it's fairer to call it Vail's code, because it was assistant Vail who designed the code, not Morse. It's first shown in Congress in 1842. He designed it with the use of this thing, which we've seen before. Anyone remember what this is? We've all actually seen one physically, I think. It's a type case, exactly, that holds all the type for when printers are setting type. Yes?
So Morse's telegraph would be the only electric one that responded to the network?
Yep, of the 18 that responded, Morse's is the only electric one in the study. So that's in part that one. And Smith very cleverly huddled off and made a financial deal with him when it came in. And as you can see, the typographers thought that E was the most important letter, so E is the most simple symbol. And after that, I, and so I, et cetera, et cetera. The code, in fact, changed a little from this. But it is a remarkable code. And in fact, it was a code that was used at sea until it was abandoned in 1997. All signal officers had to learn it. So it lasted a long time and was triumphant in many ways. So give him credit for that. The other thing he did, which is very important, he introduced a simpler system. And he said that himself. Look, I followed all those other systems. But the Cook and Wheatstone one, for instance, had five needles which could move in two directions so they could point at a whole set of letters. So that needed five wires out for every communication, five wires back for every communication. Morse said, let's do it with a single wire. And that was particularly important, too. And I think that he was probably the first to do that. Okay, so Morse then brings up the questions of, if you're going to have something like this, what are the rights and responsibilities that go with it? It clearly isn't quite like just building a printing press anymore. There are all sorts of major issues. So, for instance, when the telegraph comes to California, what you get are laws passed giving individual companies the right to build a line along certain routes. Now, why, in fact, is that probably necessary? It's clearly monopolistic. It's something that, as a country, we dislike, something California in particular is not going to be particularly well disposed to. Here we are, this swashbuckling state. It's just been formed, and we're suddenly giving individual companies the right to certain routes. Clearly, the routes out of Sacramento are going to be important. Why would that nonetheless get by if we set aside deep-seated corruption? And think on reasonable grounds, why would some people want to argue for that? Yes. So it's cheaper, you mean, so it's kind of like outsourcing by the government. The government say, we want this, but we'll outsource. Well, that's one reasonable. They tended to be the other way around, a little like Colton Robinson, that they went to the government and said, please give us the right. But still, it's reasonable. Any other thoughts on why? Well, one of the things about speculative ventures is that it's very hard to get people to say, look, I'm going to put down half the money that I have in my life on this speculative venture, which if it works will be great for everybody and good for me, but if it doesn't work, I just lose all my money. So you want to entice people to do this. Well, one way to entice them is to say you won't have any competitors. Because if someone says, well, I'm going to invest all my money in this, but someone could come along and put one right beside me, undercut me by half a cent and put me out of business and I lose all my money. So in order to entice financial speculators, often you have to give them certain restricted privileges, which seem to go against all the principles. As soon as you get this, though, you get the problem of speculative worries, that if somebody has control of a system, they can control all the messages that come along it. Now, there are some ways we talked about it, about, you know, cutting off people's cables. But the easiest and simplest and most obvious and most worrying was that financial speculation is they will know what goods are coming into town and they can bid up the market or put other people out of business. They will have the news first and therefore be able to speculate on the market. And this had been going on since the beginning of the telegraph. Stendhal, in a great novel called The Telegraph, in fact, has a very nice account of everybody in the government using this wire not only to get official signals but to pass along market information so that they can speculate. Great account of Cochrane, which I won't go into, but he's then learned, well, the best thing to do is to fake a new system. And so he claimed that there was a new system of communication with the continent and had this guy rush into the stock exchange in London covered in mud, which he'd more or less splattered outside the stock exchange, and said, Napoleon has fallen, Napoleon has fallen. The stock market shot up. Cochrane made an absolute killing before it was discovered that this was a complete phony. But you could do this kind of thing all the time if you had control over the communication network. So again, it raises all sorts of problems. So many people say, well, if the telegraph is open to all, it'll close off such speculation. but how do you open it to all if it's in the hands of private business? Because, as you saw, what Colton Robinson wants is to be able to get the news of what ships are coming into the New York harbor before anybody else. Now, what they say to the government is, well, of course, it would be really worrying if somebody else got this news because they would be able to speculate. And you say, well, why wouldn't Colton Robinson speculate? And they did, of course. Once you get a wire, you are privy to news that nobody else has, and you can manipulate financial exchanges. So out of that, you get a set of different kinds of responses. You get the response like Henry George saying, look, we have to have a way of making this fair and equitable so that certain people don't get privileged information. But on the other hand, you get these people like the New York Associated Press, started by Bennett and Moses, who ought to say, no, if we form a consortium of newspapers, we can monopolize communication and prevent any other newspaper from coming along and coming into business and to compete against us. So again, the question is, who are the rights? Now, they were making a deal with Western Union. What obligation does Western Union have to be fair? It only has an obligation to make money. So what you start to see, from the Telegraph's point of view, are massive consolidations. First, you get Western Union, which starts to amalgamate several smaller telegraphs that have been licensed, some licensed by Morse, some actually built on a non-Morse system, into a single unit. And then you get the great corporate raider, Jay Gould, one of the greatest crooks of all time, who leads several raids on Western Union until he can finally take it over. And once he takes it over, he does all sorts of things. He starts pumping up weird stock issues, selling extra stock, all of which he gets the profit from. He just sees it as a massive cash cow to milk, because it is a massive cash cow. Because the first great distributed technology, which is now going to open up communication to the whole world, is also the first great monopoly in history. And this is truly the greatest business monopoly, other than the corporate, than the state-operated ones, like the East India Company. So you get George complaining wildly. So that gets me rather late in the class, but to the assignment where I asked where you stood on this issue. I went through them all. They were pretty interesting. Came down on all sides. Lots of nuanced responses. People saying on the one hand, on the other. One saying, I'm not sure. One saying, well, I agree with this, but I don't like it. Because they're tricky questions. The yeses, as you can see, had it by quite a long way. The perhapses, quite a lot of people who say, well, on the one hand, yes, but on the other, don't like government intervention, but don't like private monopoly either. I mean, this is actually what the 19th century looks like. It's a long, long battle of people saying, don't like the way it is, but anything I can think to do to change it looks pretty unhappy too. But maybe we should and maybe we shouldn't. That comes up against, because they're amassing enormous amounts of money, huge lobbying efforts from the companies involved, because they have so much to lose or gain depending on how the law falls around them. I've gone on a long time, but just very quickly, is there anybody there who feels I put them in the wrong column, by the way? I kind of tried to assess those who seem to say on the one hand, on the other, those who are strong on one side, those on the other. Is there anybody there who feels that I got them wrong? So that's more or less how the class breaks down. In some ways, you know, the toughest position to handle, and clearly the hardest one, was the no position. Anybody want to speak a word for the no's? Any in that column willing to stand up and say why they thought no is the most important? Don't want to put anyone on the spot? Pauline, you want to?
Mm-hmm. Because,
so the issue of making it fair was important to you, but you didn't think the government was the means to do it.
Right, because if people are doing something illegal, then the government should prosecute that. But mm-hmm. Otherwise, it seems like it's kind of subjective as to what's fair, and
which is true. It raises the question a little bit then, though. I think you're right about regulation, but what then counts as illegal? It isn't entirely clear whether what Western Union and the Associated Press were doing was illegal or perfectly legal but clearly you're going to put others out of business. But I think that's important. So anybody in the perhaps column want to say where their hesitations lie? The on the one hand, one, all of you who are Libras, no doubt, on the one hand, on the other, equally balanced. You can tell that they're not strong-minded people, the people there. They're not even prepared to stand up and speak. But presumably the yeses are strong. Who wants to speak for the yeses? Who still has a strong yes that the government should? They're all going mealy-mouthed. Surely somebody out of there. Somebody, come. Nobody? Good man. Right.
I thought it was interesting that, what was his name, George?
Mm-hmm, only George. So there's a strong ground, you're saying, to protect free speech. And indeed, just as Pauline's argument was well supported in the 19th century, so a great number of Arendt's arguments were also well supported in people saying, look, there's no way that you can control these monopolies, you simply have to break them up. But the tricky thing about breaking them up is then, well, do you have just lots of parallel competitors? Well, no, because you can't get people to compete when there are 35 people on a route that maybe make enough money for two. So what happens with the breakup? Well, the government really has to sit and look over the top. Okay, and so those are more or less where the class fell. I mean, lots of people sort of hesitated and said, well, maybe this, maybe that, but I think saw that there are real dilemmas there. I mean, all I can say to you is you're both right. You know, both cases have due justice. And this goes on from 1830 into the 20th century. And it comes round again when Western Union gives way to AT&T as the next great monopoly. And that goes up until the 1980s about whether the AT&T should be broken up. Because these arguments are very hard to resolve. But they are particularly significant arguments when we get to modern technology, because it has these properties tending to monopolize. One of the reasons that it tends to monopolize is because of something called network effects. Does anyone know what network effects are? Well, the thought is that the bigger your network, the larger the network, its power increases exponentially. That is, for each member you add, you become disproportionately stronger because now they can all connect to each other. And in fact, you saw this in many ways very recently with what happened when Facebook and MySpace really came into competition. Suddenly, Facebook had so many members that adding taking yourself over to Facebook gave you access to a huge number of people, whereas adding yourself to MySpace clearly wasn't going to give you anything like the same reach. So you start to see people migrating from one to the other, and after a moment you meet what they call a tipping point, and it just takes off disproportionately. So within this, you start to get this idea of natural monopolies, that if everybody wants to talk to everybody else, they have to be within a single system. You saw it in the States, too, actually, oddly enough, with texting, which for so long in the States, unlike in other countries, was limited to people texting within that particular phone carrier's network, which was absurd. And it wasn't until quite long after everywhere else, everyone could text to everywhere else, that suddenly people realized interconnection made for an enormous, enormous distance. Okay, so we're running on. I'm just going to give a very, very quick view of what happens with the telephone. The telephone is intriguing in many ways because it really develops out of the telegraph, and it's the first time we start to see industrial research in some degree trying to find the right secret that will be bought up by a large and dominant company. So people started saying, well, look, if we can send one signal down a wire, can we send two? And duplex starts to, where you say, yeah, there is a way of sending two signals, one in each direction simultaneously. Can we then send four? And Edison starts to develop the quadruplex, all of them really hoping to sell or funded by Western Union. They all know who their target audience is, and they're all developing now what looks like industrial research. And finally, you get Bell coming along and starting to say, hey, not only can I get more signals down the wire, but actually I can start to render them into what he calls visible speech first and then sound, that we can now not only get the same signal or more signal down the wire, but we can actually build something on either end where we can hear it. But it all develops out of telegraph research, moving in towards the telegraph. It's a huge battle because the rewards many people see are going to be enormous. As you can see from that statement of Bell's, you can suddenly start to encourage investors because it's such a promising system. But what it becomes is not so much a war of technology, because once again, as with the telegraph, everybody is doing the same thing. It becomes a patent war. It's who gets to the patent office first. And highly significant, there's a chap called Gardner Hubbard. He was Bell's lawyer. He had a child who was deaf, and Bell had worked on teaching the deaf. And in fact, his daughter married Bell, so he was also in the family. He had spent a long time rattling the chain of Gould and Western Union, particularly Western Union, and saying they should be made public, they should be broken up. So he was a deep, deep antagonist of Western Union. So when his mate comes along with the telephone and offers to sell it to Western Union refuses to buy it, quite possibly because they disliked Hubbard so much. But Hubbard also is the one who says to Bell, look, don't worry about refining this, get it patented. And in fact, there are lots of shenanigan stories that say it's quite possible that Hubbard got word from the patent office that Gray was about to put a caveat in at the patent office. So they rush in ahead and get their patent in about an hour before. And that makes all the difference in the world. So in fact, it's come to be known by some, Christopher Beecham's phrase, as an industry shaped by law. It's not really technology which explains the basis of the telephone company. It's really law. It's really who was able to put up the best fight for a patent. Morse, for instance, filed his first patent in 1837. The final one was settled in 1854, and he thought it cost him $500,000. Ramez, sorry, did you want to say something? No, I thought you were. No? Oh, okay, sorry. I thought you were talking. Sorry, okay. Bell then has a major problem because he gets caught in lawsuits. He has to go to war with Western Union, who is trying to use patents by Gray and Edison and Callahan, who runs the Goldstock Company. And they want, in many ways, to claim our patents are prior or our patents are better. And it's really the courts, once again. It's not the technology that wins. It's the courts once more. It took him 18 years, and there were 600 actions in the courts. So again, when we want to try to understand these things, we're now trying to understand them not in terms simply of a better technology, but it's often in terms of a better set of lawyers. And that's the battle which is really going on. And so when we want to talk about the infrastructure into which these things are built, we have to think of the legal infrastructure and the way it was constructed. And one of the things in the legal infrastructure, of course, is the extent to which the courts are going to favor local inventions over foreign inventions. And that becomes. Okay, so that then says, all right, so how does this tie into national policy? Well, clearly we can see differences. What happens in the UK, where the telegraph is developed, as well as it is in the States, but before too long, the post office decides to take it over. In the 1868s, the telegraph is nationalized. Now, exactly the same debate was going on in the States, but in fact, it was decided in the end, or really was never quite decided. It just never got enough support to be nationalized. So England, UK, France, you get a national system. In the States, you get a private system. But it's a private system that does lead, as we talk, to private monopolies. So Western Union becomes a private monopoly, and so AT&T then succeeds it as a private monopoly. You see them then going from, and I'm not going to go through all the details, clearly where we're coming to the end, just a lot of very small systems, but slowly networks affect us, such that people really realize that they have to join the big systems to be any good. If you can say to somebody, look, you can just call across town, then you're offering them one thing, but if you say you can call across the country, what you're offering them is really quite different. The system is also changing too, because the telegraph was almost entirely not used by private individuals. It was used almost entirely at first by the press, by government, and by corporations. Whereas the telephone fairly quickly becomes, in many ways says, is driven by individual markets. And that changes very much the way in which it's going to develop. Okay, let's just quickly, then other systems come up. One problem is if you have lots of systems, if you want them to compete, should you therefore oblige them to interconnect? If they don't interconnect, then clearly a dominant system is going to say, well, then you have to join my system or else you can't talk to the people on my line. That becomes both a technological debate, developing systems that allow you to interconnect, and we're going to come back to all of this when we come to the internet all over again. How did all those different systems of communication get networked together? That happens with the telegraph, then it happens with the telephone. One of the major switching systems, in fact, was the great Science Express system in San Francisco. But it was a complex problem. It was a complex international problem as well. Do you have to modify your national system if you want to be able to connect to international systems? In fact, the transatlantic cable, which we didn't talk much about or at all, in fact, is another complex question. Well, is it going to be the American system which dominates, which we said which is politically and structurally quite different, or the English system? The first time the cable is put up, in fact, the problem is solved by the fact that the cable breaks within days, so no one has to. And in fact, after that, it's really the British who build a cable over to Canada, to Newfoundland, and then it's connected from Canada down here. Okay, so let me stop there. So there is the outline now, which we're going to look forward to as we start to look to new technologies. Keep your eye on the fact that the infrastructure into which these are built is no longer looking at an individual technology or an individual inventor, but this enormous set of complex relations, the infrastructure, social, political, and legal. All right, thanks very much.